Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good to see us all here again. After our little hiatus again, we resume our study in the Wisdom and Center Perfection, the Whole Counsel of God, Lesson 49, entitled Of Delay and Decay. Of Delay and Decay. And our primary passage today is Exodus 32. And if those who have Bibles, go ahead and turn to Exodus 32, and we'll read the main emphasis will be on the very first verse, but there's some important points to be had elsewhere. Beginning at verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron, and said unto him, Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graven tool, after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation, and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink, and rose up to play. Verse 7. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go, get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereunto, and said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Passing down to verse 15. There's a beautiful passage of intercession there. We'll get into that later. 15. Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand. The tables were written on both their sides. On the one side and on the other were they written. And the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, There is a noise of war in the camp. And he said, Moses, that is, It is not the voice of them that shout for mastery, neither is it the voice of them that cry for being overcome, but the noise of them that sing do I hear. And it came to pass, as soon as he came nigh unto the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hands and brake them beneath the mount. And he took the calf which they had made, and burnt it in the fire, and ground it to powder, and strawed it upon the water, and made the children of Israel to drink it. And Moses said unto Aaron, What did this people unto thee, that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people, that they are set on mischief. For they said unto me, Make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. And I said unto them, Whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it me, and I cast it into the fire, and there came out this calf, all by itself. Surprise, surprise. Okay, that's the main text that we want to concentrate on. Now let's turn to the first verse again. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, this was the occasion of their problem. They had the control, they had the external control of Moses, but Moses had left Aaron in charge, according to, I believe it's Exodus 24, verse 16. He gave charge that when he was up doing, having communion with God and receiving the law and the terms of the covenant between the people and their God who brought them all the way out of Egypt to the foot of this mountain to receive God's law, Aaron's in charge. But when they saw that Moses wasn't coming back, that is when the problem occurred. Now, it so happened that this happened on day 39 of all things. Moses was up for 40 days, and the rebellion occurred on the 39th day, just before one more day had they held out, but no, impatience prevailed. Okay. And so this bodes ill when the Lord goes away or calls one of our people to serve him in a special way, and then we use that as an occasion. The famous phrase is, when the cat's away, the mice will play, right? Well, the cat is the enemy of the mouse. Moses was not the enemy of Israel. Matter of fact, we see in verses 10 following that he actually did intercession for Israel. God said, I'll wipe them out and I'll raise up a nation out of you to fulfill the promise to Abraham. And it was very tempting for Moses to have his son be the great recipient of the promise of Abraham. and Israel wiped out. And he knew Israel deserved to be wiped out for what they did. But Moses rather said, "Nay, let me be accursed and my brethren live." So he acted the part of intercessor rather than, you know, judge. There was a test for Moses too, by the way, to see how he would respond to God's proposal to destroy Israel and build a nation out of Moses' loins, which Moses rejected. He'd rather see Israel saved than his own family elevated forever, which is an astonishing thing, astonishing man. But this astonishing man, who is out of sight, out of mind, now that people are restless, they don't see him, his presence is no longer among them, the manifestations of his power are not there, there's just his representative Aaron, the one that Moses charged to take care of business while he was about God's business up on the mountain, right? So too Jesus was taken up in a cloud, just as Moses entered the cloud at the top of the mountain and is delaying to come down. But Jesus, as Moses did not leave people without charge to take care of things for him. Jesus built his church, established officers over it, also, it should be pointed out, established civil rule across the world. You know, there is no power but that which is of God, and they are all given charge to do their jobs. Okay, very simple. In the meantime, what is the people's reaction? Do they respond in faith? Are they patient? Do they observe to do all? By the way, they bound themselves. We will do all the words of this covenant, of this law. They swore that they were going to do it. When God thundered it out from the mountaintop of Horeb, they said, "All this we will do, and our children, and we bind ourselves to this covenant." Including, by the way, should be pointed out, the second commandment not to make a graven image. Okay. So Moses delayed to come out of the mount. And I'm not the only commentator who's drawn attention to this passage and its connection with Jesus being seated at the right hand of heaven at the moment where we can't see him. We are not going to be satisfied with our five senses, touching, feeling, smelling, hearing, seeing Jesus. It's not going to happen any more than anyone could do any of those things with Moses. No one could truly say they knew exactly what happened to Moses, other than that God, who did all these wonders, brought him up to get the law and to bring it back down. In other words, it was a mighty work that was being given unto Moses as minister of God, just as Jesus is doing a mighty work at the right hand of God, ruling the universe, and his rod extending out as a scepter to dash the nations as shepherds, as a potsherd, into shards. See? So, we are not mindful of this fact. The people lost their touch with the fact because he wasn't visible anymore. Moses wasn't there ruling them day by day externally. They were now on their own internal resources of spirituality. And those petered out after 39 days. Didn't take long. That's why God truly says they have quickly turned aside out of the way. Chances are very good that the rebellion started to spring up, first in little bunches of discontent. Where's Moses? He's not here anymore. And all of a sudden this becomes the license to do what you want. But the people gathered themselves together. Now we have a gathering of the people. Consensus starts to take form. Remember the other gathering of the people. The nations gather themselves together, and the kings of the earth, to take counsel against God and his anointed. This is the same kind of gathering in principle as Psalm 2 warns us against. The heathen do rage, and the princes gather together and make counsel together. They gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, now they're making a demand of the person who is in charge, what they want. The people now want things, now seeing as how Moses is not around. And they say this, "Up, make us gods for which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him." We don't know what happened to him. Well, it wasn't eaten by a bird. He didn't fall into the ocean. He went up to be with God, and therefore he's still with God. It's a real lame excuse. If the point is Moses isn't around, we think he's gone forever. He's not coming back. He died or something happened up on the mountain. The point is that they shouldn't have asked for gods. Moses wasn't their God. So why, if Moses is gone, do we want to have gods? Why don't we just say, make us a governor to rule us, or you be governor over us now, Aaron, permanently? The complaint was we no longer have someone to rule us. Then why are they asking to make gods? Okay. One hypothesis said, well, if Aaron was capable of making gods, then since he was a god-maker, he would then show himself fit to be a governor. Maybe that's the explanation. But the point is, it doesn't make much sense for them to ask for gods. except they knew that Moses would have forbidden it, and Moses' absence now permits them to do pretty much anything they want, including making their own gods, gods to suit themselves rather than the God who brought them there. So they are not going to make their own gods after the real true God comes in. And we'll find out that they are very good at worshiping this false god that they make. They don't fail to sacrifice everything necessary to build the god, which I find astonishing. We don't know what became of him. This parallels, as Matthew Henry points out, the interesting question in one of the letters of Peter, where is the promise of his coming? You know, things continue as from before. So how do you know that Jesus is coming back? Things are just the same day after day. There's a delay in that coming too. And so this is urged as a reason to do what you want. Jesus is not coming back. He would have come back already if he was coming back, right? So therefore, he's not coming back. So too, the proposal is Moses is not coming back. The reason we're bringing up this whole discussion is to say that the world today, in America in particular, as well as all the other nations on the earth, are at the same stage as Israel was on day 39. And they're acting in terms of day 39. We don't know what became of Jesus. He walked around 2,000 years ago. He supposedly went up in a cloud, and we haven't seen or heard hide nor hair of him since. That simple. Therefore, we'll make our own gods, worship them, suit our own needs. Aaron proposes to try to make it costly for them. He wants to say, well, we'll really see how dead set they are on making gods. Give me all your earrings. You've got to take all your wives and all your daughters, and you rip the earrings out of their ears. And he thought, this would be too high a price to pay. They said, oh, forget that stuff. I want to look pretty. I don't want to take rid of my earrings. Well, so lo and behold, come, you know, half a ton of earrings all of a sudden. They were dead set on worshiping this God. They were true to their false God, whereas the average Christian is false to the true God. So we have a lesson to learn from this pagan worship that Israel instituted. They're much better at doing that and being faithful to a falsehood than we are faithful worshiping and serving the true God. Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with the graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. They have now put a face, a image, a symbol on God. They say, these are the gods that brought us out of Egypt. And Aaron attempts to tie this back in now with the worship of the true God. See? He says, all right, well, they're weak. They need some help. We'll go ahead and let this transgression stand now that the thing is going. He said, at least they'll be worshiping Jehovah, even if they have to have this, you know, golden calf floating around in the middle to help them out, just to ease the impatience with Moses. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. He built an altar. And Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. That word Lord, if you look in your Bible, is caps and lower, small caps, meaning this is a feast unto Jehovah. This was a Jehovah feast. The golden calf symbolized Jehovah. Except that God forbade this worship of himself in this form. It was a direct violation of the second commandment. Okay. So now we have idolatry with the Christian face put on it, with a God-approved face on it. We are worshiping Jehovah, and they used the word Jehovah and the name Jehovah, and they made a Jehovah feast, and they followed the rules of the earlier chapters of Exodus about how a peace offering and a thank offering should be offered. They did all the things according to the law of God, except that they were offering it to an image of Jehovah in the form of a calf, which is what they remembered from Egypt, the worship of Apis, the ox god. So now we have a feast unto Jehovah, by name, anyway. Aaron puts his own imprimatur, his own stamp of approval on it. This is a feast for Jehovah, boys and girls. Except it really isn't. It's only that in name. And all that Aaron urges to say this is being done in the name of Jehovah, for Jehovah, and these are thank offerings by according to Jehovah's law, they are not. But it's important to see that respectability has been plastered all over this transaction, all over this golden calf. They might as well have written Jehovah on it and say, see, we're worshiping Jehovah, the God who created the universe, under the symbol of this. But look past that. So we here have something very important for our modern Christianity. our country is loaded with millions of golden calves, all with Jehovah's name plastered on them, and none of them having anything whatsoever to do with the true, faithful, holy worship and service unto God himself, except that you have the equivalents of Aaron all over. Aaron stood in two offices as Moses' vice president, if you will, or right-hand man. He was head of the priests, being Aaron in person, the chief priest and high priest of Israel. So he was the religious office, held the highest religious office in the land. But Moses was also the highest civil officer in the land. He dealt with all matters of justice as well. He was the closest thing they had to a king, was Moses, the leader. And Aaron was leader when Moses was absent. So he was both their civil ruler and their religious ruler. And so the lessons split into two halves. What Aaron is doing has a civil context, meaning we can see the same error in civil government, where the people clamor for things and then the rulers give it to them simply because the people ask. Whether it was right or wrong to give it to them, they cave in to the people. And by the same token, in the religious realm, we see him taking false doctrines, false ideas, false notions, simply because they're popular, simply because the entire tumultuous population is taken up with this thing, and then trying to say, well, this is of God. This will say that this is a Christian option, say. Christians can legitimately do this, blah, blah, blah. Like Christians for pro-choice would be something like that. You know, God wouldn't want women to have to be pregnant if they don't want to be. And then all of a sudden, you'd have the name of Christ being invoked in the name of murder, among other things. But nonetheless, it's a golden calf with Jehovah's name on it. And a proclamation. This is a feast unto Jehovah. This is service to God, when in fact it is not. The social gospel is a very good example in our generation, where communism and Marxism is promoted because it is the ethic of the New Testament to share and share alike. Therefore, the rich should be killed and the property dispersed to the poor, because the rich are oppressors. And this now has the mark of Christian respectability, when in fact it is in violation of every known canon of biblical law respecting property rights. So we see golden calves on all accounts. And why are they predominant? Because Jesus has delayed his coming. Is this a fault of Jesus? No, the error is in the people. The error is in the people. The error is twofold. The people and the errands out there. Every church has his errand, has its errand, its ruler, its leader. Every civil government has an errand at the top of it. An errand, whoever he may be, whether it's a George Bush or a Francois Mitterrand or a Helmut Kohl in Germany, these are all errands who have a moment of truth before them. Will I cave in to error and try to whitewash it as truth and right? Or will I stand up and maybe get swept away by the mob, but trust God? Will I take my heat for doing right, or will I cave in to the popular will? Will I follow the multitude? See? And that's the error, the problem that we have today, is that we have so many errands today in positions of authority that willingly follow the errand of Exodus 32. And are very quick to make excuses, as we shall see later on in the chapter. Okay, so they now have it. And Aaron makes a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Notice verse 6, and they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings. It should be pointed out that this action rejuvenated the country. They were pretty lackadaisical during the wait for Moses. In other words, their service for God was half-baked, was not in earnest, was not diligent, was not genuine. It was, they had no convictions about it. They were just antsy about the absence, and sin no longer could be restrained in them as a consequence. But now, with the false system set up, in the name of Jehovah, they rise up early and start offering offerings. In other words, the country turned around. It had a tremendous rebirth of interest in what was going on. Unfortunately, it was all misdirected. This applies to our presidential election, which is imminent, that there may be, maybe Mr. Clinton gets in, maybe Mr. Perot gets in, maybe Mr. Bush gets in, but regardless of what's going to be, there is a national feeling of rejuvenation. especially if someone other than Bush gets in, there's a clear sense of a change in the winds. And this will bring people who are rising up early, offering their offerings, so to speak. That is, now the New World Order is going to be proclaimed. America's on a new foot. Change has transpired. The people have spoken. And we're going to get what we want. But essentially, we are choosing ourselves gods to go before us in this election, just as Israel chose gods to go before them that they credited with getting them out of Egypt. So too, this country is selecting and making its gods as it goes to the polling booth. In no less a sense than happened here. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. This was part of the problem, was that the festivities transpired. There was no longer any rein or control or leash or restraint, is the word I'm looking for, on them. And so after the big feast, which was illegitimate because directed toward the false idol, though in the name of Jehovah, they rose up to play. Lasciviousness and all sorts of wantonness came into play. There was no more restraint from Moses, so they did what they pleased. Hedonism, in other words, the pursuit of all pleasure, became the rule. And pretty amazing, considering as this is both the day they started it and the day that Moses gets back. So it was a very, very short period of time, 24-hour period of time, when the nation went from good, but barely restrained will to evil, to all-out evil in the name of Jehovah. Okay. So now we have the problem that they are also indulging in their lusts. On a grand scale, all the people were doing this. There were no restraints on the people. Remember from Psalm 2, let us cast their cords from us. Fling, no more boundaries, no more limits. We can do what we want, with whom we want, whenever we want. And it was just a disaster, of course, morally speaking, when all the boundaries and barriers and limits were pulled off the people by themselves. In principle, you can see that they will do the law of God. They'll offer a peace offering according to God's requirements. You cut it like this, you wave it in the air, you say this, and you do that, and they go, and fornication prevails, and wild revelries and things like that. You can put them both together. You can have a nation that'll have both sitting side by side. Israel did it. You can have the worship of the false god, Jehovah's name being invoked, and all the forms being followed for how the offerings should be done, how a communion say is to be done, how the church service should be run, and then the nation goes out and runs wild. Okay. And the Lord said unto Moses, go get thee down. By the way, this is an interruption. Moses was interrupted in his communion. Now God had his, what's interesting here is that God could easily have sent Moses down on day 38 and there would have been no problem, right? Okay. And it should be pointed out that even Aaron, when he makes his excuse, he said, look, no one knew where the heck you were. People rose up wondering where you were. We thought you're gone. If you showed up here, it wouldn't have happened. So Moses' delay is even urged by Aaron as an excuse. He said, we didn't know where Moses was. Where was you? Where were you? You delayed to come out of the mountain. Well, the fact of the matter is that God kept Moses back. God knew full well what was going on the entire time. He knew every single second of what was going on, and he kept Moses in the mountain. And he sent Moses down when it was time to send Moses down, after sin had conceived and given birth, so that it could be properly punished out of the midst of the people. So the delay of Christ, likewise, is intentional. And yes, it brings all this thing out. All the worms and the dead fish, as they say, pop out in the sunlight. So too, this delay is causing all the problems that we see. Yes, Christ is delayed, and he stays at the right hand of the Father until the restitution of all things, basically, and that's being done by the Holy Spirit. But in the meantime, we can see the effects of that delay. That delay of Christ is a test of character for the world. It's a test of character for everyone in the world that he hasn't come back yet. And now, are we going to walk according to his will? Are we going to take advantage of the delay and say, my master is delayed? See, that's from one of the Proverbs. I mean, not from the Proverbs, one of the parables of Christ about the evil husbandman, my master is delayed. And that is the occasion for a sin in the book of Matthew, as Jesus paints that picture in that parable. The famous phrase, my master is delayed. I can do things now, since he's not coming back yet. But guess what? The master always comes back. When you least expect it, you're elected. You're the star today on the judgment seat, I'm afraid, but there you go. So now we see clearly Moses is told by God, go get thee down, for thy people, which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. What is interesting is that up until this point, God always called them my people that I have brought out of Egypt. And now it's your people that you brought out of Egypt. God is hands-offing the people. They're not my people anymore. They're worshiping a big piece of metal down there now. And on top of all the immorality that suddenly popped up all over the place. Your people that you brought out of Egypt. This parallels when Jesus, who had previously called the temple, don't you know I have to be in my Father's house? When the Pharisees fulfill their evil desires, God says, Jesus says to them, behold, your house is left unto you desolate, pointing to the temple. It used to be my Father's house, now it's your house. It's not my Father's house anymore. He's left this place long ago due to your sinful behavior and your hatred of him and your false service. So to thy people that you brought out of Egypt. God explains further, they have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto and said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. God is saying that in a very, very short period of time, he, Jehovah, has been supplanted in worship and service by the people. And they've set up their own system to suit their own liking. America as a nation falls in the same boat. We were set up as a Christian nation, and how quickly we have turned aside and created our own gods to worship rather than the true God that brought us up. From all the nations, from the least of the nations, from a shoreline populated by Indians into a mightiest nation on the earth, and we have forgotten where we've come from. And notice this, quickly out of the way which I commanded them, we have deviated out of the path of God's commands. Nothing could be truer than our country matching and paralleling this description by God of Israel. There's a passage here which we'll get into later having to do with Moses' intercession for the country. Verse 15, Moses turned and went down from the mount, and the two tables of the testimony were in his hand. He had brought down the terms of God's covenant, which was the law, the Ten Commandments of God. The tables were written on both their sides, on the one side and on the other side were they written, and the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables. These were not graven by Moses. These were not graven by an angel. These were direct finger of God writing on these pieces of stone. Okay. So now God has supplied his word. He meets Joshua, who's been standing guard just below the cloud on top of the mountain. It is not war sounds. Moses knows this merely because he's been keyed in advance. That the problem was that the people had corrupted themselves and were dancing and having a feast. That's the only reason that Joshua did not know that it was war sounds in the camp, but that Moses had a clue as to what was going on. The noise of them that sing do I hear. Matter of fact, interestingly, in the original Hebrew, the songs are, this word here would be translated the antiphones, which are the early Hebrew psalms that were antiphonal songs that would go one group then the other. And those were the kind that were being sung. Not just bawdy beer-drinking songs, say, but worship songs of Jehovah. The Hebrew antiphons were being sung, except what? Around the calf. You can see how furious Moses must have been by the time he saw that these holy songs unto Jehovah were being intermingled with the worship of the golden calf and all the sexual immorality and wild behavior, party time, if you will. Party time is the way to put it. 20th century phrase. And it came to pass, verse 19, as soon as he came nigh unto the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hands and brake them beneath the mount. A lot of commentators have tried to come to grips. Did Moses sin in doing this? Was it like when he smashed the stick against the rock at Meribah to get water out of it? Was it the same kind of thing? Was this Moses' temper? No. You see, he was angry for God's sake. He was not like Yehu, who said, who will help me avenge myself? This was a matter of God's honor being totally defiled in the nation, openly. And there's more to be said on this point. First and foremost, if these commandments were the grievous burdens that everyone would have thought they would be, Moses would simply have held them up and applied them and said, we're going to do this. No, the law is not burdensome. The commandment is not burdensome. In actual fact, the two tables of the law written in God's hands were the greatest blessing that the nation could have. And Moses comes down on day 40 to deliver them to the nation. And the nation has forfeited its right to the blessings of God's law. And Moses therefore destroys them, not out of a fit of anger, certainly nothing personal anger, but rather, you don't deserve the blessings represented in the Ten Commandments. And you smashed them to smithereens and broke them. And the law is the greatest blessing that anyone can have. It was the great curse that people imagine it to be in modern Christianity. Moses would have done better to hold on to them. Say, oh boy, do I got something to fix you, the law. The other way around, you don't deserve the blessings and the happiness that the law gives you. Bam! And smashes them to pieces. Showing that the greatest displeasure that God can show a nation is to take away the law from them. And therefore all the curses flow into a nation to whom the law is no longer available or no longer preached, no longer regarded, except as a strange thing, to use the phrase of Hosea, Ephraim, which is another phrase for Israel. It says, I showed Ephraim the great things out of my law, but he esteemed them a strange thing. Which is in essence the same thing as taking the law away. So the law is taken away from Israel. And the taking away of God's law is regarded by Moses symbolically as an act of judgment of God, that he would withdraw the law. It's an act of judgment because the law is such a stupendous blessing. We read elsewhere in Deuteronomy, what nation is so great that God would give him the blessings of the law, that they would rise to be a mighty nation and trample others underfoot, and people would live under their own vine and fig tree forever, and their children and children's children's, they'd see them grow happy and old and play safely in the streets. You don't see that today in most of America. Safety in the streets. Try that in downtown Los Angeles. Have your children play safely in the streets there. It's not going to happen. Okay, so the withdrawal of God's law and the blessings of it are step one in the curse of God. God showing his tremendous displeasure with the nation when he withdraws his law from them. Now here it's done physically. The actual tables of God's law are smashed and broken. It is done in the 20th century different ways. It's done by critics of the Bible, atheists, fools, if you will, to use a scriptural phrase from Psalm 14. These men don't believe in the law of God, so they malign it from the position that God never wrote it in the first place. There is no law of God. These are laws of men, ancient laws. We can dispense with them, make our own laws. But the second indicator that the country is under the judgment of God is that from the pulpits that preach the Gospels, the law is cast down and broken regularly, a sign of God's displeasure that he has so many men willing to trample the law of God underfoot and say, we're not under the law of God, we're under grace. Then you will enjoy none of the blessings of either law or grace as a consequence of a lawless position. So the law has been trampled and broken by American Christianity, by and large. Showing again that the nation is under tremendous judgment. We are on day 40 as well as we are on day 39. We are seeing not only the uprising of various different gods to adhere to and to worship and to feast with in the name of Jesus, in the name of Christ, in the name of God, but we are also seeing the secondary step of the law of God, the blessings of God that are manifest in the law, that are contained in it, being broken by both the enemies of God and the friends of God. And I call this a judgment of God. God is judging his people by sending them pastors that do this. I truly believe that in my heart. That they, just as Moses broke the tables because the Israel did not deserve the blessings, so too this people walks in such a way they do not deserve the blessings of God's law. And therefore antinomian pastors have proliferated across the entire land and are in the majority now, so that the people would be lulled and they would be dull of hearing and not know when God strikes them, because they have seen fit to follow other gods in the first place. He cast the tables out of his hands and break them beneath the mount. What's left of God's law at that point but crumbled pieces of stone that no one can receive anymore? So too is the law of God in modern Christianity. In almost all the nations of the earth, the law of God is trampled underfoot. Ironically, as Isaiah 42 points out in 49, the islands and nations wait for his law. It's something that they desperately need, and no blessings will flow to them until it appears and has its working. God, Jesus came. The whole point of the new covenant was that I will write my law in their hearts, and on their minds will I write them, and they shall be to me a God, and I shall be to them. They shall be to me people, and I shall be their God, and they shall know me from the least to the greatest. That blessing can no longer be secured and is undercut when the law of God is broken in the pulpit by those who should be preaching it and teaching it rather than undermining it. He took the calf which they made, and he burnt it in the fire, ground it to powder. It burned, by the way, because it was mostly wood, wooden frame overlaid with gold. That's why it burned. So when they burned it in the fire, now we had just melted gold on top of charcoal by that time. And he ground it up into powder, and he threw it uphill in the stream, Brook of Kidron or something like that, if memory serves from Deuteronomy, the parallel, and it flowed into the water supply, and so the people were actually forced to eat their own idol. To show them, he pulverized it and forced them to eat it. He says, what kind of God is this that I could force you to eat him and consume him and destroy him? You'll eat your own gods that you make with your own hands. You'll be forced to eat them, which will prove them to be impotent, powerless, idiotic things to worship. And you brought shame and reproach on yourselves as well as being forced to consume your own idol with your own mouth. Now what has Moses made of their false god? Moses didn't think highly of it, obviously, of how they presumed to worship Jehovah. We live in an era when freedom is proclaimed. The liberty of Christ, we can worship him almost any way we want. No, you can't. Don't make that mistake. Yes, there's 614 odd commandments, and within those contexts and some of the ones that are added in the New Testament, you have freedom within those boundaries. They broke commandment number 2. It's hard to believe that with only 10 major ones that were thundered out, that they would miss that and make a graven image. So you cannot worship God in violation of his law. Are you going to eat it, basically? As they did. They had to drink that idol back up. Sure didn't make the waters taste that good. Made the children of Israel to drink it. They were forced to eat their own God. To show who prevailed, Moses or the false God. God will not allow anything to interfere with the true worship of himself. And now comes interesting conversation. Moses said unto Aaron, what did this people unto thee that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? Which means, what did they do that was so bad to you that you returned evil for the evil? What did they do to you? Some commentators felt that perhaps they put the gun, so to speak, to Aaron's head, says, do it or we kill you. And they bring to bear the speculation that Hur, who used to be shoulder and shoulder with Aaron, remember Aaron and Hur held up Moses' hands in the battle against Amalek, no longer heard from after this point in the Bible. Maybe he was killed. And Aaron saw Hur was murdered for not helping make it. He said, well, I guess we can make anything you want if you really want me to, seeing as how I don't want to end up like Hur. That's speculation. No one knows for a fact whether that happened. And the intent of Moses' phrase is not to the end or the meaning that did they force you to do it, but what bad things did they do that would make you want to punish them by making them a calf? And this is the question that can be pointed at every civil and every religious leader in the country for what they are doing and how they are voting. What did the people do to you that you would want to pass legislation like that? What did people do to you that you would do such a thing in church and preach this from the pulpit and lead them astray so badly? The question of Moses to Aaron is a question that lives today and cries out to be answered by everyone occupying a pulpit or a seat of power or authority. What did the people do to you that was so bad that they deserved to have you as ruler over them to do things like what you've done? Very good question. The answer was straight out of the Garden of Eden. Adam, did you eat? The woman made me. Eve, the snake made me. So Aaron, the people made me do it. The people made me do it. Didn't say the devil made me do it, or the snake made me do it. But he sure wasn't. This is not a terribly repentant attitude. You've seen very little in the way of penitence on Aaron's part. We learn from Deuteronomy that it was very lucky for Aaron there that some of the details are filled in that are missing in Exodus. When Moses recorded it in Deuteronomy, he points out that he had to intercede personally on Aaron's behalf that God not kill him, judge him. Aaron really blew it, and he was a leader of the goof. Okay. So we see his reaction. First, let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people that they are set on mischief, that their hearts are set on iniquity. Okay. He uses this as an excuse. Since they're set on it, their hearts are set on mischief, I just attempted to control it and to channel it into the most constructive, Jehovah-fearing way I could think of. I did the best I could with what I had, was his basic position. You shouldn't be angry at me. You know how they are. Try to do better. No one could have done better than I did under the circumstance, which is baloney, isn't it? It's just an excuse raised to try to get Moses off his back. And it's what the people will tell you. Said, hey, if I preach fiscal responsibility, I won't get elected. I can't help the people unless I say no new taxes and I'll increase your entitlements and welfare and the whole lot. The people want this. If I say I'm going to touch Social Security, then old people who vote will blow me out of office. Okay? So people who are in political arenas and in church arenas worry about what the people think. If a pastor starts saying unpopular things, he can see the tides go into the toilet, and then he can see the session looking for another pastor real quick. Right? If I don't hear, you know, 10 horror stories a month from Rush to News or somebody else about what's going on in the country in terms of pastors being ejected for being faithful and the people being set on mischief and licentiousness and libertinism, that would be a small number considering what's actually happening out there. What little I hear reported is tip of the iceberg of the judgment that this country is undergoing because the people want things their way and they will not tolerate a pastor or a ruler who won't give it to them. This is part of the catastrophe that America is living with right now. They said unto me, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. He again hits Moses for his delay, which is foolish because it was God's delay, not Moses' delay. But he also makes it pretty clear in the first phrase, they said unto me, make us gods, which shall go before us. There's a famous phrase called vox populi, vox dei. You well know that the voice of the people is the voice of God. The people have spoken. The Romans use this phrase. It's Latin, obviously. And this is what he's urging. The people wanted it. The people said, do this. They said, make us. There's a command. Give us this. We want it. Kennedy will say, the people asks for national health insurance. FDR, the people wanted Social Security. I had to give it to them. No, you didn't. They weren't supposed to have it. They were asking for what didn't belong to them. Other people's money, basically. That is not an excuse that works with God, to say the least. And I said unto them, whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. In other words, I tried to make it difficult for them, saying, well, if you want that kind of stuff, you're going to have to give up things. Well, you know, not only did this happen there, where they were more than willing to break off the gold and hand it to him, nations that want to have total control, like Sweden, the government turns around and says, well, if you want that, you're going to have 90% tax rate. And they say, fine! We only want 10% of our income if we can have cradle-to-grave security and all the health care paid for and all the pornography we want in the works. And they will gladly give up virtually everything to have their false god and to worship it and to live and serve it. So they gave it me. Then I cast it in the fire. He basically says, I just flung the gold in the fire and out pops this calf at the other end. Moses is so disgusted with it that he doesn't even answer. His contempt for Aaron is so hot at this point that this cockamamie story about I just threw it in and miraculously out came this gold calf all by itself. It kind of formed itself, you know. It's a kind of a miraculous thing. Out it popped. I don't know where that calf came from. You can see why it was necessary for Moses to have to pray for Aaron with this kind of story being fed him. When everyone, we just read earlier that he was out with the graving tools and everything to form it and fix it so it should not move the works. He was the guy with the chisel and the skills to do this. He was an artificer when he worked in Egypt. And out came this calf. Well, this is going to be an awful lot like what we're going to answer to God for. A lot of the pastors and civil rulers are going to say, they wanted this, they gave me the tax money, I flung it into committee, and out popped the program. I don't know how that program got started. Funding of abortions, it just happened. It wasn't me. And just as Moses doesn't answer Aaron, so God will merely point to the left side of his throne on that day when people answer him this way. Uh-huh, I see. Step aside. I've heard enough. Make a decision. Pretty serious when you get down to it. Is there a question in the back? Oh, okay. So we're in this kind of spot. We're on day 39 and 40. But there's something else that's important. Sure, we are living under judgment. There's no question that I can see that this is not a nation getting ready for a rapture at all. It's a nation getting ready for judgment. By the way, who executed the judgment on this day? If we read a little farther, we see that it was necessary to go through the camp and to judge the evildoers and the leaders of the false worship. It was not done by God directly. Not like when God opened up the earth, opened up her mouth and swallowed Korah and Dathan and all the rebellion whole, as in Numbers 16, verse 40. Not like that. Not like when God struck Abiathar straight dead directly. No, this was appointed for human instruments to handle it. This instance, it was the Levites coming in to slay their brothers. 3,000, I believe, is the number of those that were killed in the purge. Want to call it a purge, fine. But this was God's purge. It was legitimate. It was earned. It's not like a purge by Stalin or Lenin, believe me. Not the same thing. Yes?
Do you know how many Israelites there were altogether? You know, there were 3,000 and got killed. How many other guys were there?
It's up there, close to 1 million, if I'm not mistaken. There's a lot of them. The numbers of men are given in numbers, of course. And
so it wasn't all of them, then? It was
no, these were the main leaders. It wasn't the people who were still in on it and were still rebellious and not repentant. The stiff-necked ones who felt they still could withstand Moses. Yeah, they went through and nailed everybody. See, there was a basic watershed when when Moses said, "Who was on the Lord's side?" Remember? Verse 20. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who was on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me," and all the sons of Levi. And he said unto them, "Thus saith the Lord God, put every man his sword, and slay every man his brother, and every man his companion, and every man his neighbor." And they did according to the word, and there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men, which were those who, by their failure to respond to Moses, proved they were not on Jehovah's side. They could repent and stay, or they could dig in their heels and say, "I like it this way. I prefer the calf, and I resent you making me eat the calf." And we're going to make another one as soon as we get a chance, because that's the mindset, the mischief that Aaron spoke about. It was real enough, but Aaron's responsibility was not to cave in to the people's sin and to put a face on it and to incarnate it by building a calf. That's what all these federal programs are, the Social Security program and the federal taxation system, which takes from the rich and gives to the poor and redistributes wealth. All of this is sin institutionalized by Aarons who gave into the people's, in this case, envy. Envy feeds the tax system. Soak the rich. We even have it in the cartoons, the editorial cartoons for this election. Bush says, you know, don't soak anybody. And Clinton says, soak the rich. And Perot says, soak everybody. So you soak nobody, soak everybody, soak the rich. But someone gets soaked because you feel, that, unless you're Bush, that they deserve to be soaked. And that's the instance. This class warfare is institutionalized. And here the class is Moses, who takes too much upon himself, in their view, and Aaron. So this is equally a rebellion. Now, what's our position? We can take the view that, yes, God is doing all these things. God has withdrawn his law as a sign of his displeasure. The blessings of God's law no longer multiply across our nation. Fortunately, there's a small cadre of a remnant, if you will, that is preaching the law, and they're growing, and hopefully their voice will become stronger and more focused with time. And God's Spirit will open the way for, you know, make an entrance of his word, to use the scriptural language. But the temptation for us is to say, let's go get them. Let's go make them eat that calf. We need to take the intercessory view of Moses. And let's read what happened here. And this will be our close. Verse 9, and the Lord said unto Moses, while they're still on the mountain, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Boy, that's America, that's most of the nations of the world. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation. Now what's the first command? Let me alone. It reads also in the margin, if you will, suffer me, and I will, or in other words, let me. Let me, leave me alone, and I'm going to do this. If you leave me alone, you know what I'm saying? Suffer me, or let me do this, or leave me be, or just don't do anything, and I'll go ahead and take care of this. If you fail to act, if you just stay there, quiet, I'll go ahead and take care of business. So just be quiet, and that'll let me. See what I'm saying? I'm getting the point is that Moses understands from what God is telling him that if Moses just sits tight, God's going to do. He's going to wipe him out. And it's the test of the intercessor in Moses that he would now stand. And notice the temptation is twofold. Not only was it going to have to take some strength of courage to speak up to God, who's ready to blow a whole nation off the earth in the next minute, right? But there's an added bonus for Moses if he keeps his mouth shut. And I will make of thee a great nation. I'm angry with them, I'm furious with them. I'm going to consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation. Just let me alone. Suffer me, and I will do this. Let me, and I'll do this. And Moses besought the Lord as God, did not leave him alone. Pleaded with God and said, Lord, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people, which thou hast brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil against thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and saidst unto them, I'll multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of I will give unto your seed, and they will inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil which he thought to do unto his people. Moses withstood the test. The temptation for us is to look around and say, they deserve it. But actually, our capacity is to function as a Moses today, which is to intercede on God's behalf, and then to go bring the law to the people and try to undo the evil that has been done. And however small the efforts, God is with it, remember? Even the seven eyes of the Lord are on the plumb line that's in Zerubbabel's hand. Even the smallest efforts, God will honor if they're done in faith. And they can, lots of people doing a small amount, truly and faithfully in holy service to Jehovah, can turn the nation. And hence, of delay and decay, we don't have to have the nation go into decay because of Christ's delay. We can function as A, an intercessor, and B, as a builder, and as a proclaimer of God's law. And we must learn the lesson of Aaron never to cave in to the multitude, regardless of what they want and how badly they want it. Because it was a mischievous frame of mind that caused them to want it in the first place. And therefore the entering in of God's word will give them understanding to see the folly. And we must essentially take the broken shards of God's law that is left in all the pulpits of America virtually and glue them back together and re-deliver them to the people and say, here, O nations of the earth, is God's word for you from the King of Kings who sits on high, whose kingdom is over all authority. And then we can be effective as servants of Christ to do his will in a world that is living on the 39th and 40th days of Moses' delay as we wait for Christ to come back.